This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. After co-creating and writing the phenomenally popular series Seinfeld, Larry David moved from behind the scenes to star in his own HBO series, Curb Your Enthusiasm, which recently completed its fourth season. In the series, Larry David plays an exaggerated version of himself. The chief difference, he says, is that the TV Larry does and says things that the real-life Larry doesn't have the nerve to. And the TV Larry, for saying what he thinks, usually pays for it. Curb's second season is now out on DVD. We'll hear from Larry David in a few minutes, but first, let's listen to Terry's recent interview with Robert Whitey. He's an executive producer and director of Curb. Whitey also has made documentaries about his comic heroes, including Lenny Bruce, Mort Saul, and the Marx Brothers, and is working on one now about Kurt Vonnegut. In Curb Your Enthusiasm, many of the plots are based on real-life incidents that actually happened to someone working on the show. Whitey told Terry about one of them.
A few years ago, a friend of mine passed away, and it was all very sad, but the friends got together that night of the funeral. And, you know, my friend lived alone, and he wasn't married, and there was talk about if, you know, his family would eventually be going through his apartment and gathering things. And one of us said, gee, should we go in there first and sort of make a run and see if there's anything that, you know, maybe he wouldn't want his family to discover. And so after a little bit of drinking, we all decided that we should sort of have an understanding that we do that with each other. And if anybody, you know, went prematurely, the others would go into, you know, their home or apartment and start to look to see if there was, you know, any magazines or anything lying about. And so I brought that to Larry, and that wound up being a story in season one, I guess it was, the Porno Gill episode, where Jeff is in the hospital. He's about to have some emergency bypass and asks Larry to go to his house, tells him where the secret stash of pornography is, and asks Larry to gather it up so his wife doesn't find it if, God forbid, something happens on the operating table. But Larry's brilliance, again, was weaving that into a story that he already had about this ex-porno star. And when Larry goes into the house and finds the stash, he finds a tape that, you know, this friend that he just had dinner with appears in and puts it on, and then Jeff's parents walk in. So he can take these ideas and just find a way to fashion them into something way beyond anything you could imagine would ever be that funny.
Well, let's hear a scene from the Porno Gill episode. And this is from Curb Your Enthusiasm, the Larry David Show.
This key right here.
Mysterious.
Very mysterious. This key right here, my front door. I need you to go into my house, okay? Go up to my bedroom, to the left of the TV. There's a cabinet by the bookcase there. Open it up, move the linens. There's linens in there. Move them to the side, push on the back door, and it'll open up. Inside there, I have like my porn collection. I have like 7-8 porn tapes, a couple of magazines, all right? I need you to get them out of there. You got to get it out of there because if something happens to me...
Oh, right, you're thinking like if the anesthesia, something goes wrong.
Anything goes wrong.
So in case you die, you don't want your wife to discover your porno stuff?
She doesn't understand that. I'm not embarrassed in front of anybody.
I don't really understand it either, but
okay,
that's okay.
That's your own deal.
Yeah, okay.
That's your own deal, Repression
but,
Jones.
You know, well, what about, is there an alarm code or anything like that?
Easy. 9988.
I better write that down.
In there should be a pen and a piece of paper.
9988. Okay.
I can't believe you have to write it down.
What am I going to do with these things?
Keep it in your trunk.
What if I get in an accident on the way home? What about that? And this
porn goes flying
strewn all over the car and all over my bleeding body.
You'll
this
be
alarm
fine.
Code, I'm worried about this too.
Oh, nothing's gonna happen.
I'm no good with stuff like that. It's too technical for me.
9988.
The alarm's gonna go off. There'll be a SWAT team descending on me. This whole thing just has disaster written all over it.
It'll be fine. I trust me.
And your wife better not show up.
Yeah, I guarantee she's not gonna be there. She'll be here. I appreciate it. You're
good
great
luck.
Pal. You're a great pal. I appreciate
Try
it.
Try not to die.
Try not to die. Thank you.
How did you start working with Larry David?
Larry and I have known each other for more than 20 years now, and we met initially. I was heading up development for the production management team of Rollins and Joffe, who produce all of Woody Allen's movies and have been with him from the beginning. And, oh, they've managed every great comedian from Robin Williams to Billy Crystal to Robert Klein and Martin Short and on and on. But I was their development person about 20 years ago, a little more, And so one of my duties was to read scripts that came in for non-Woody Allen projects. And the script came on my desk called Prognosis Negative, and I read it, and it was one of the funniest scripts I'd ever read. And I said to the guys, well, we have to bring in this writer, Larry David. This is such a funny script. And we all did know Larry because Larry, at that time, had appeared on a show called Fridays, which was a late-night variety comedy show. So we brought Larry in for these meetings. Now, the story of Prognosis Negative was typical Larry David. It was about a fellow much like Larry. This was, again, you know, years ago, so it would have been the younger Larry, who was single, who was dating and just could never make a commitment to a woman. And he'd go through one relationship after another because he couldn't commit. And then finally he finds out that a woman that he dated a few years ago, who was nice, he quite liked her, finds out that she's terminally ill. And that she doesn't know it. That's the beautiful thing. He finds out accidentally from a doctor. And so he thinks, well, this is the perfect relationship because I can go out with her and I can commit to her. And in, what she got, 6 months? In 6 months, it'll be over. So that was sort of the basis of the story. So so Larry would come in for these meetings with myself and the executives there. And the executives would say to Larry, you know, we love the script. It's very, very funny. But boy, this character... You know, he's not very sympathetic. Do you think there's anything you can do to make him a little more sympathetic, a little more likable? And Larry would think about it and then say, no, I don't think so. No, not at all. So it was more important to him to sort of stick to his guns about that character rather than make an easy sale to get the film made and to change it. So I just thought, well, I like this guy. I like his way of thinking. So we started to hang out. I'd go to the clubs with him, the comedy clubs. He was doing stand-up in those days. And so many nights I'd be with him in the clubs and he'd be on stage performing. And some nights he'd do rather well, but there were nights when he would just bomb terribly. And I would just be in the back of the room laughing because I thought the material was brilliant and the audiences did not know what to make of him. And they would just stare up at him like carp in a pond. And I remember thinking, boy, if the country ever caught up to this guy's sense of humor, there'll be chaos in the streets.
What was his stand-up act like?
Well, it was unlike anything else I had seen. First of all, Larry would come out on stage, and there was no good evening, how are you, anything like that. He actually looked a little bit like a deer caught in the headlights behind that microphone. And this is one night I remember. This was sort of typical of what he would do. He would come out on stage, and the first thing he'd say was, "Every morning I wake up and thank God that I wasn't born a wealthy Spanish landowner."
Because what?
Which is, you know, a typical opening for a comedy monologue. He said, because if I were, I would never know whether to address the help using the to form or the usted form. He'd say, if I use the usted form, I don't want them to feel I'm being condescending, yet if I use the to form, I don't want them to feel so familiar that they can just come into my kitchen and help themselves to anything in my refrigerator. And that would be the kind of thing that would just knock me on the floor, because to me that was a very sort of Robert Benchley-esque sort of concept, something that harkened back to the days of Benchley and Perlman and those great wits. But the audience was, you know, usually it was 1:30 in the morning and they were sort of drunk and they wanted the, you know, the obvious sex jokes. And I'm telling you, I would be hysterical, but people would be throwing things at him. People would be shouting to him to get off the stage. And Larry has a very combative personality, so he was no shrinking violet. He would start shouting back at the audience. And then there would be the people in the audience who were ready to jump up there and punch him, and then other people who'd be shouting at them to, you know, let him talk. And this melee would break out in the audience for the pro-Larry faction and the anti-Larry faction. And I saw that happen on more than one night.
Robert Whitey is executive producer and one of the directors of Curb Your Enthusiasm. We'll hear more from him and Larry David after this break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Robert Whitey, executive producer and director of Larry David's show, Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Since you've directed so many documentaries about comics, I'm wondering where you think Larry David fits into modern comedy. Because he's kind of like an insult comic, but it's not like he's Don Rickles or something. I mean, he insults. It's more like obnoxious than insulting, though. He insults people all around, but there are people in his real world, since this is a sitcom.
Right. Well, what is interesting is, as schooled as I was in the great comedians, both of the silent era and, you know, the golden age, the 30s, Larry is familiar with very little of that. He, you know, he's never seen a complete Marx Brothers movie or a W.C. Fields movie, and this is the stuff I grew up on. And Larry and I, a couple of years ago, went to a Harold Lloyd film. It was the first time he had seen Harold Lloyd, maybe the first time he had seen an entire silent feature. And afterwards, we walked out of that theater, and his jaw was agape, and he just said, "My God, that was so funny. I didn't know that silent films were so funny." The only real influences that I've known him to cite have been Abbott and Costello, and really from the TV years more than from their films, and Phil Silvers and Bilko and all of that. But that's what's interesting, is that he is that intuitive. He doesn't give a second thought to really his comic persona in any sort of historical sense. And I'm always thinking about that. And it even informs the way sometimes I'll direct or stage things, or what I'll contribute to stories, whatever. If Larry is doing battle with a little kid, well, that can be uncomfortable unless that little kid has really done something to deserve Larry's wrath. And that was sort of W.C. Fields' thing, is that he could go after Baby Leroy, but only after Baby Leroy dumped Fields, you know, pocket watch into, you know, the molasses and was acting like a real brat. And sometimes with Larry and Jeff, I'll stage things in the way that Laurel and Hardy would do it, where if they're facing Jeff's wife, Susie, who's screaming at them, Larry will sort of hide behind Jeff's girth, which is a very kind of Laurel and Hardy move.
This season, Larry David has been cast by Mel Brooks in The Producers, in the role of Max Bialystock, originated by Nathan Lane. How did that plot idea get hatched?
Larry and I were actually in New York a few years ago, I think, doing some publicity for maybe it was the second season or the third season, and we saw The Producers in New York, not with Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick, but another cast that was in. And Larry, just watching these people on stage singing and dancing, just was flabbergasted. How did they do that? How do they memorize all that? How do they know all the steps? And he just thought it was the scariest notion in the world. And then he started to think, geez, what if I were put in that situation where I had to do all that? And again, that was just an idea that grew out of that moment of seeing the show. And the season finale this year is the opening night of The Producers on Broadway. And audiences can see if disaster strikes or not when Larry takes to the boards.
Well, Robert Whitey, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Terry.
Bob Whitey, speaking earlier this year with Terry Gross.